A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You come home from work and your toilet has been removed from the floor, not leaking into your apartment. The leak was downstairs. The landlord sent a plumber while you were out. You just walk in and there's a hole where your toilet used to be.
That's one of the milder stories.
Then there's the leak dripping onto a couple's bed. They ask the landlord for a repair timeline, terminate the lease, fix nothing, and force a family with a 6-month-old infant out of their home. They end up on a relative's floor with a screaming baby.
These aren't hypotheticals. These are things that happened to the person who sent us this prompt. Daniel, our friend, our housemate, the guy whose name is on the show. A decade of renting in Jerusalem, and he's accumulated landlords who felt less like business people and more like villains cast out of a horror movie.
His question isn't about the law, though the law is part of it. His question is darker. He says these were some of the only social interactions where he genuinely wondered if the person he was dealing with was sadistic, taking some kind of perverse pleasure in causing misery to another human being. His lawyer, someone who does property law for a living, told him that in her experience, all landlords are basically like this.
Which is a hell of a thing for a professional to say. She's not being hyperbolic. She's describing a pattern she sees every day.
Here's the question Daniel is really asking. Is there something about being a landlord that selects for a certain kind of disordered person? Someone with a personality disorder, maybe? Or does the power dynamic itself create the behavior? Are these bad people who happen to go into the business of being a landlord, or does being a landlord make people bad?
The shared thread across every one of his nightmare landlords, he put it in one line that I haven't been able to shake, is that they don't see tenants as humans.
That's the question we're going to spend the next half hour trying to answer. Not with anecdotes, though we've got plenty. With data, psychology, and law. Because if the system is producing this kind of behavior at scale, we need to understand why.
Let's put some numbers on this before we go deeper. About 30% of Israeli households are renters, according to the Central Bureau of Statistics 2024 data. That's roughly a third of the country living under someone else's roof, subject to someone else's decisions about whether their home stays habitable.
Subject to a legal framework that, compared to Western Europe or even most of North America, is astonishingly thin on tenant protections. No statutory repair timeline. No mandatory notice before a landlord enters your apartment. 30 days to terminate a month-to-month lease. No cause needed.
You've got a massive population with almost no structural leverage. That's the Petri dish.
Into that Petri dish, Daniel dropped 3 nightmare landlords in a decade. Not one bad experience you could write off as a fluke. 3 distinct human beings, 3 separate properties, and in each case the behavior wasn't just negligent. It felt designed to inflict maximum distress.
The toilet removal is almost a dark comedy if you're not the one living it. But the leak onto the bed, where a family with an infant asks for a repair timeline and the landlord's response is to terminate the lease, fix nothing, and force them out. That's not negligence. Negligence is forgetting to call the plumber. This is looking at a family with a 6-month-old and choosing displacement over a phone call.
Which is why the lawyer's comment lands so hard. She does property law every day. She's seen the pattern repeat across dozens of clients. And her professional conclusion is that all landlords are basically like this. That's not a frustrated tenant venting. That's an officer of the court describing what she sees.
Now we should be precise about what she probably meant. She's not saying every single landlord on earth is a sadist. She's saying the ones who end up in legal disputes, the ones tenants need lawyers to deal with, follow a recognizable pattern of dehumanizing behavior.
And that's the thesis we want to take seriously. We're not here to litigate whether Daniel had bad luck with 3 random jerks. We're asking whether the landlord-tenant relationship in Israel is structurally designed to produce dehumanization. Whether the system itself selects for certain personalities, or warps normal people into behaving pathologically, or both.
The phrase personality disorder is heavy, Daniel used it deliberately, and I think he earned the right to ask it. When someone displaces your family with an infant rather than fix a leak, you're allowed to wonder what's going on in their head.
We're going to look at this from three angles. The legal structure that enables the behavior, the psychology of what arbitrary power does to people, and the selection effect, who becomes a landlord in this system and what the role does to them once they're in it.
Because if the lawyer is even partly right, if the system reliably produces this outcome, then we're not talking about a few bad apples. We're talking about a machine designed to strip tenants of their humanity, one leaking ceiling at a time. Let's start with the system itself. Because before we ask whether landlords are broken, we need to ask whether the law is broken.
The answer, just to spoil the suspense, is that Israeli rental law is basically a landlord's playground. I want to walk through the specific mechanics because the details matter here.
Let's take the entry question first. In most functioning democracies, your landlord can't just walk into your home. Germany requires at least 24 hours notice, and even then only for specific reasons. The UK requires 24 hours written notice. The law says landlords have a right to reasonable access for repairs. That's it.
Which the courts have never strictly defined. So, reasonable means whatever the landlord decides, it means until a judge says otherwise, which almost never happens, because who's taking their landlord to court over a single unauthorized entry?
And this is how you get the toilet situation. The plumber shows up during a workday, no call, no notice, and physically removes a toilet from the floor. The landlord was exercising reasonable access for a repair. The fact that the repair was for a leak in the apartment below, and the tenant came home to a hole in their bathroom floor, that's not a legal violation. That's just Tuesday in the Israeli rental market.
Now layer on the repair obligation. Israeli law requires landlords to maintain the property in a habitable condition. Sounds good on paper, but there's no statutory deadline, no requirement to fix anything within a specific time frame. A leak can drip onto your bed for weeks, and the landlord is technically in compliance as long as they're working on it.
This is where Daniel's bed leak case becomes instructive. The landlord had zero legal obligation to provide a repair timeline, zero obligation to fix the leak during the lease period. He could simply terminate the lease with 30 days' notice, no cause needed, under the rent and eviction law, and walk away. The leak becomes the next tenant's problem.
Which is exactly what happened. Family with a 6-month-old asks when the leak will be fixed. Landlord's legal options, fix it, or terminate the lease and do nothing. He chose the second one. And the law not only permitted it, it made that choice cost him nothing.
Now let's talk about the power asymmetry mechanism, because this is where it gets disturbing. In a normal business transaction, both parties have recourse. The coffee shop gives you a cold latte, you ask for a new one, or you don't go back. The contractor does shoddy work, you withhold final payment. There's leverage on both sides.
The tenant's only leverage is withholding rent. And in Israel, withholding rent is illegal. It can lead to eviction within 60 days. So your one move, the only card you hold, gets you thrown out faster than the leak gets fixed.
The landlord knows this. They know you can't withhold rent without risking homelessness. They know you won't sue because the legal fees exceed the disputed amount. They know the power runs entirely in one direction. You live in their property. Your children sleep under their roof. Your entire domestic existence depends on their goodwill.
There's a concept from political theory that maps onto this almost perfectly. Petty sovereignty. It describes a situation where someone has arbitrary power over another person's basic living conditions, with no meaningful accountability. The sovereign doesn't have to be a king. It can be a bureaucrat at the DMV, a prison guard, or, in this case, a landlord who decides whether your ceiling gets fixed.
The psychological research on what petty sovereignty does to people is not subtle. The Stanford Prison Experiment in 1971, ordinary college students assigned to be guards started psychologically abusing prisoners within days. Zimbardo had to shut the whole thing down after 6 days when it was scheduled for 2 weeks.
The Milgram Experiments in 1963. Ordinary people told to administer electric shocks to a stranger. 65% went all the way to what they believed were lethal voltages, just because a man in a lab coat told them to.
The consistent finding across decades of power research is that giving ordinary people arbitrary control over others erodes empathy. Not in a few bad apples. In the majority. Rates exceeding 60% across multiple study designs. The power itself does the work.
Which means we have to take seriously the possibility that the landlord who displaced Daniel's family wasn't a uniquely terrible person. He might have been an ordinary person placed in the system that gave him absolute power over a family's housing, with no consequences for cruelty and no incentive for decency.
The system doesn't just permit the cruelty, it rewards it. The landlord who terminates the lease, rather than fixing the leak, saves money on repairs and gets a new tenant who doesn't know about the problem. The landlord who enters without notice gets the repair done on his schedule, not yours. Every incentive points toward treating tenants as problems to be managed rather than humans to be housed.
Let's contrast this with jurisdictions that have actually built structural safeguards. Berlin's rent cap, the Mietendeckel, was introduced in 2021. It was later overturned by Germany's Constitutional Court, but while it was in effect, tenant harassment complaints dropped by 40%. Not because Berlin landlords suddenly became better people, because the law changed the cost-benefit calculation of abuse.
France has had a winter eviction moratorium, the Trêve Hivernale, since 1956. November 1st through March 31st, no evictions. It doesn't matter if the tenant hasn't paid, it doesn't matter if the lease is terminated. You cannot put someone on the street in winter. That's 70 years of a society saying that housing stability matters more than property rights, at least during the coldest months.
In California, Civil Code 1942 gives tenants the right to repair and deduct. If the landlord won't fix a habitability violation, the tenant can fix it themselves and deduct up to 1 month's rent. That flips the power dynamic entirely. Suddenly, the landlord has an incentive to fix things fast, because the alternative is the tenant hiring someone and sending them the bill.
None of these protections exist in Israel. No repair and deduct, no winter moratorium, no mandatory notice for entry, no statutory repair timeline, no good cause requirement for eviction. The law doesn't just fail to prevent abuse. It actively enables it by giving landlords arbitrary discretion with no counterweight.
When Daniel asks whether these are bad people or a bad system, the structural evidence points hard in one direction. The system is designed to produce exactly the behavior he experienced. The landlord who removed his toilet without notice wasn't breaking the law. He was using it.
Structure alone doesn't explain the sadism. For that, we need to look at who becomes a landlord and what the role does to them.
The selection question. Daniel asked it directly. Is there something about being a landlord that selects for a certain kind of disordered person? And there's actually data on this. Israeli real estate investors skew heavily toward older men, 55 plus, with high risk tolerance and low empathy scores on standard psychometric measures.
I want to be careful with that finding because low empathy sounds like we're pathologizing an entire demographic. What the research actually shows is that people who self-select into property investment tend to score higher on traits like pragmatism and emotional detachment, which in a business context can be assets, but in a landlord-tenant relationship translate directly into the kind of dehumanization Daniel described.
The guy who can look at a family with a six-month-old and see a lease to terminate rather than humans to house. That's not necessarily a sadist. That's someone whose empathy circuits have been bypassed by the structure of the transaction.
Here's the thing about the passive income, fantasy. Real estate in Israel is marketed as effortless wealth. Buy a property, rent it out, collect checks. The brochures don't show the 3 a.m. phone calls about burst pipes. They don't mention the tenant who needs an extension because they lost their job.
You get this mismatch. The landlord signed up for passive income, emphasis on passive, and instead got active, messy human conflict. The tenant isn't a revenue stream. The tenant is a person with problems. And that gap between expectation and reality breeds resentment.
Resentment that expresses itself as punishment. How dare you complicate my passive income with your leaking ceiling and your infant child? The tenant becomes the problem, not the leak.
Which brings us to the moral licensing mechanism. Landlords who see themselves as providing housing, a social good, feel entitled to behave poorly because they believe they're already doing a favor. I'm giving you a roof over your head. How dare you ask me to fix it too?
It's the psychological equivalent of, I brought snacks to the party so I don't have to help clean up. Except the stakes are someone's home.
This pattern isn't uniquely Israeli. New York's slumlord crisis has been documented for decades. Landlords who deliberately withhold repairs to drive out rent-controlled tenants. London's no-fault eviction epidemic, Section 21 notices, where landlords terminate tenancies for no reason at all.
The UK is actually in the process of abolishing Section 21, the Renters Reform Bill. But it's taken years of political fighting, and landlords have fought it every step of the way. The pattern is the same everywhere. When the law gives landlords arbitrary power, a predictable percentage of them will use it cruelly.
Which brings us back to the lawyer's claim. All landlords are basically like this. Is that true?
A 2023 study by the Israel Democracy Institute found that 15 to 20% of landlords account for over 70% of formal tenant complaints. That's a classic Pareto distribution. It's not that all landlords are monsters. It's that a minority of them are, and the system lets them operate with impunity.
The lawyer was both right and wrong. She was right that the pattern is pervasive enough to be professionally recognizable. She was wrong that it's universal. But from a tenant's perspective, the distinction barely matters, because you don't know which kind of landlord you got until the leak starts.
The structural insight here is the one we've been building toward. The evidence supports the normal people who become bad landlords. Model more than the bad people who become landlords. Model. Berlin's 40% drop in harassment complaints under the rent cap is the smoking gun. Berlin landlords didn't undergo mass psychotherapy in 2021. The law changed, and their behavior changed with it.
Which means the personality disorder framing, as useful as it is for understanding the experience, is dangerous as an explanation. It lets the system off the hook. If the problem is sick individuals, you don't need structural reform. You just need better people.
The data says the opposite. Put ordinary people in a system that gives them absolute power with no accountability, and the majority will eventually use that power in ways that harm others. The Stanford guards weren't pre-selected for sadism. They were college students who answered a newspaper ad.
Daniel's third landlord, the one who displaced a family with an infant rather than fix a leak, may not have been a uniquely terrible person before he bought that apartment. He may have been an ordinary Israeli who, placed in a structure that rewarded cruelty and punished nothing, gradually stopped seeing his tenants as humans.
If the system is the problem, what do we do about it? Let's get practical.
First, for tenants stuck in this right now, document everything in writing. WhatsApp messages are admissible in Israeli small claims court. Every conversation with your landlord about repairs, every ignored request, every unauthorized entry, screenshot it, date it, save it somewhere that isn't your phone.
The Ministry of Housing has a tenant protection unit that actually does take complaints. Most people don't know it exists. It won't fix your leak tomorrow, but it builds a paper trail that matters if things escalate.
On withholding rent, it's technically illegal, and we have to say that. But practically speaking, when you're sleeping under a dripping ceiling with an infant, it's often the only leverage that works. Just know the risk. The landlord can file for eviction within 60 days. You're betting they won't bother.
Which is why Israel desperately needs a repair and deduct law. California's Civil Code 1942 lets tenants fix habitability violations themselves and deduct up to 1 month's rent. That single provision flips the entire power dynamic. Suddenly, the landlord has a financial incentive to show up fast.
Mandatory 48-hour notice for entry. Good cause requirement for eviction. You can't just terminate a lease because a tenant asked you to fix something. These exist across the OECD. They're not radical. They're baseline.
Here's the thing I want listeners to sit with. The personality disorder framing. It's useful for understanding what the experience feels like. When someone displaces your family rather than pick up the phone, sadist is the word that fits. But as an explanation, it's dangerous. It lets the system off the hook entirely.
If the problem is broken individuals, you don't need structural reform. You just need those people to not be landlords. But the data says that's not how this works. Berlin didn't fix its landlord problem by screening for empathy. It fixed it by changing what landlords were allowed to do.
Focus on the structure. Pathologizing individuals feels satisfying, but it's a dead end. The Stanford guards weren't pre-selected. They were random students handed a uniform and absolute power. The system made them what they became.
That brings us to the broader takeaway. The landlord-tenant relationship is one of the last unregulated power dynamics in modern life. Employer-employee has labor law, workplace safety codes, anti-discrimination protections, doctor-patient has medical ethics boards, malpractice law, informed consent requirements. Teacher-student has professional standards, oversight committees, mandatory reporting.
Even customer-business relationships have consumer protection agencies. You can report a restaurant for health violations and someone actually shows up.
Landlord-tenant has almost none of that. No professional code, no oversight body with teeth, no mandatory training or licensing beyond basic property registration. It's a relationship where one party controls the other's shelter, and the only accountability is a court system most tenants can't afford to access.
That vacuum is what creates the conditions for abuse. Not bad people, a bad system that lets ordinary people act terribly without consequence. Fix the vacuum and the behavior changes. Berlin proved it. Even with all those fixes, there's a deeper question Daniel's story forces us to confront. He asked whether these are bad people who happen to be landlords, or whether being a landlord makes people bad. And the evidence, I think, says both. The system selects for certain traits. Emotional detachment, pragmatism, comfort with power, asymmetry, and then it amplifies them. It takes whatever baseline tendency existed and turns the dial to 11.
The landlord who displaced a family with an infant might have started as a perfectly decent person who just wanted passive income. A decade of absolute power over tenants' lives, with no consequences for cruelty and no reward for decency. And you get someone who looks at a leaking ceiling and sees a lease to terminate instead of a family to house.
Which brings us to the question we should leave listeners with. What would it take to make the landlord-tenant relationship a human one? Is regulation enough? Repair and deduct, mandatory notice, good cause eviction. Those would stop the worst abuses. But would they make landlords see tenants as people?
Or do we need a different model entirely? Housing cooperatives, where residents collectively own and manage their buildings. Community land trusts, where the land is held in common and housing is permanently affordable. Public housing built at scale, where the landlord is a democratic institution with accountability structures.
Those aren't hypotheticals. Vienna houses 60% of its population in social housing. Singapore's Housing Development Board manages homes for 80% of the country. These places exist. They just require a society to decide that housing is more than an asset class.
Here's what I keep coming back to. Daniel ended his prompt with a line that I think is the real thesis of this whole thing. The shared commonality across all of them seems to be not seeing tenants as humans.
That's it. That's the whole problem in 9 words. And it's one that law alone may not solve. You can regulate behavior. You can't legislate recognition of another person's humanity.
The law can stop the landlord from removing your toilet without notice. It can make him fix the leak. It can prevent him from evicting you for asking. But it can't make him see you. That part. The part where a person looks at a family and sees humans rather than problems. That might require something deeper than policy.
Or maybe policy is how you get there. Berlin's 40% drop in harassment complaints suggests that when you change what people are allowed to do, you eventually change how they see. The behavior shifts first. The recognition follows.
Or maybe we're asking the wrong question. Maybe the goal isn't to make landlords more humane. Maybe it's to build a system where nobody has that kind of arbitrary power over someone else's home in the first place.
That's the discomfort I want to leave listeners sitting with. Not a policy prescription, not a neat resolution, just the question of what it would take to live in a world where housing isn't a weapon.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1903, the Seychelles installed a clock in Victoria's clock tower that was deliberately set to run 12 minutes slow, not due to mechanical error, but because the colonial administration wanted the workday to start later without officially changing the posted hours.
So they just gaslit an entire island about what time it was.
That's a landlord move, if I've ever heard one.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us your own questions or your own nightmare rental stories, email the show@myweirdprompts.com.
Or visit us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back next week. Try not to get evicted in the meantime.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.